This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
9:36, you're listening to The Morning Run. Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sherrod Kutin here with me. It's time now for Pressing Matters, the show that takes you behind the headlines of the day, or in this case, behind the headlines of the year. It's joining us for our review of the biggest news of 2016 is Zurairi AR, Assistant News Editor and Columnist at The Malay Mail Online. Zurairi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me
again.
Yeah,
great to have you here. Sherrod, we're taking a look at some of the biggest themes this year, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, perhaps all of us have different ideas of what was the news that really shaped politics and Malaysian society this year. I thought we could start with the politics of religion, not religion itself, but really the way in which religion becomes either an idiom or becomes part of a bargaining chip in, you know, in kind of political negotiations in the country. And I thought the one thing, of course, that we've been occupied with, and it's still making headlines, is amendments to the Sharia Court Act. Some people call it the Hudud Law. Zurairi, do you think that was a big story this year?
Of course. I think not only is it a big story this year, it is bound to be, to continue being a big story even to the next year and probably to the next election. I think I've joked before that you will know when the election is going to be when they stop talking about it, because they've done it's done and dusted.
Yeah. So this is an interesting thing, right? So some people with a more conspiratorial turn of mind will say that you know, by not actually concluding the deal on Hudud and amendments to the Sharia Court Act, what it leaves is the possibility of UMNO being able to mobilize support for itself as seen as a champion of the Islamic agenda, a pass being able to say, well, we're going to be delivering this, but just vote for us now, and you know, and then we'll deliver it after the elections. That it won't be done as well before the elections, but it will be a promise.
It's like a carrot, right?
Yeah.
Perhaps. But I think ultimately, it might be a strategy for both UMNO and PAS, but I think as of now, UMNO is a bigger winner, I think, in this case. Because, well, you call it Act 355, right? Before this, PAS has been putting it as a way for them to, it's a barrier towards implementing Hudud Law and better Sharia law. But I think after the amendments that have been made in the recent tabling by Dato' Sri Abdul Hadi Awang, it has been so watered down, and it is now a bastardized version of what they have originally in mind, how they would want to implement Hudud and other Sharia laws. And UMNO, on the other hand, has been seen as being the upper hand. I mean, they have facilitated the tabling of the act. They have contributed towards amending what was finally tabled by Abdul Hadi, and so on. So UMNO, in this case, it has succeeded in banishing a boogeyman that's been haunting them for so many years. That they are the blocking, they are the blocking towards implementing Hudud. So now it's no more.
Okay, so the question is, I guess, the big question is, why did PAS go down this route? We know that when Nick Aziz was still alive, he constantly reminded the party of its bad experiences in the 70s when they got together with UMNO. This time around, without Nick Aziz's leadership, we have Hadi Awang, who seems quite willing to go into this compact with UMNO. He's, you know, discarded the Pakatan Rakyat, you know, kind of compact and the common policy platform that they had, except that in Selangor, of course, we still have its Pakatan Harapan Plus.
It's a weird mix. It's a menage
That's a very interesting thing, right? Are we looking at the simple divisions in Malaysian politics disappearing, that we'll have these complex arrangements across the federation, and you could have different configurations? We had even in Perlis a very interesting kind of a vote that was taken to show that this may be the sign of the times, right? We had the MCA guy abstaining. We had the PKR guy saying no to the legislation that was going to facilitate conversion, unilateral conversion of minors to Islam.
Yeah, I think what it shows here, I mean, with the Act 355 and also in Perlis, what happened is that I think people are politicians, and they are trying to assert themselves, especially when it comes to the status quo. I think they the Islamist lobby and the Malay status quo are saying that they are getting threatened. I mean, their position in Malaysia. So this is one way of trying to assert your status quo and your perhaps superiority in this country. So,
What does it do for Barisan Nasional? Because Barisan Nasional was always like the middle.
I think it has never to do with BN, but rather with UMNO itself, asserting their dominance over BN. I mean, just in General Assembly, you could see that they donned the colour blue instead of red this time around. So I think it might perhaps implicitly send a message that UMNO is BN and BN is UMNO. Without UMNO, there's no BN. And all the other component parties, I mean, they must... You know?
But they didn't wear green.
I think they drew the line to aqua blue.
No, but Hadi did wear red.
I just want to come back to this point about the changing political dynamics because of the issue of religion, right? The question of religion. You know, you talked about how in different states, perhaps that's the future, that's the way of the future, that there'll be different political unions at different points in time. I don't know how well that would go down with the voter who's always thought in terms of blue, red and green and, you know, or orange or whatever it may be, but very kind of clear, strict lines.
Yeah, but it might bring to an interesting point in Malaysian politics where it's no longer about whether you are opposition or government, but which party you would put forward a more cohesive or more interesting proposition policy-wise. So you might have a... I don't know, we might finally see some sort of coalition government where it is not necessarily between a so-called government parties or MBN or an opposition party. I mean,
okay, that's a possibility. We see that in mature democracies, Germany, for a federation. Mm-hmm. You know, you have parties together at a federal level, and then maybe in opposition at a state level. I mean, you have all these different permutations. But do you really see that happening in Malaysia, especially on the question of policy? It seems that so little real policy exactly. discussions are happening.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's one of the reasons why, as of right now, Pakatan Harapan is not making inroads. I mean, they're trying to stay somewhere in the middle. I mean, they're trying to appeal to the urban as well as the rural conservative demographics. I mean,
yeah.
How to get both of those?
How to have both sides?
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
But I think it's made complicated by the issue of religion, because you're not just talking policy, Sharad. You're talking about policy on religion, which is a very divisive topic, right?
Yeah. What about the question of coming out of this? Because I think in some ways the red herring is religion. The reality is how do you maintain power or capture state power in the case, right? So what will work in terms of that agenda? So you push the religion button or you push the race button or regional buttons, right? Johor,
yes.
And we can talk more about this. Sabah and Sarawak. Also, in fact, Adnan Satim's very strong statement that Sarawak would not stand for Sharia being, imposed in any part of the federation. This was against the 63 agreement, that the very basis of Malaysia is threatened by this agenda. You know, I think that was a very strong statement. Do you watch Sarawak very much, Zurairi?
Not as much as I would like to. I mean, I have to admit. I mean, but. I think the Sarawak elections was it was a foregone conclusion, don't you think? I mean, but what caught my interest was that in the run up towards the Sarawak elections, you could see that the Adnan Satims and MBN, they have been playing this a separate game from their Malayan brethren. I mean, they are trying to put forward Sarawak as very different from Peninsular Malaysia. I mean, we don't have all those racial strife and all the religious division back in Sarawak. So they're making it as if that the Sarawak government under that administration is very inclusive and very, very different. So vote for us. So and that worked. So
in fact, you had DAP Sarawak sounding very much like they were in the same camp, except trying to push Adnan Satim further. Perhaps we can come back with more on kind of regional pulls, which I think is the other big story for Malaysia in politics this year.
That's right. So stay tuned to Pressing Matters right here on BFM 89.9. 9:46, good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Zurairi AR, Assistant News Editor and Columnist with the Malay Mail Online, is on the show with us today. And we're talking about some major themes that have been dominating headlines this year. Earlier, we spoke about the politicization of religions, of Islam. And then I think another big theme of the year has also been challenges to federalism. And we saw that kickstart the year with the elections, the by-elections in Sarawak.
Yeah. Melissa, I mean, people might not know who Zuraria. I mean, he's got a huge number of followers on Twitter.
And I'm a huge follower of him. Retweet everything.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Me too. And also, I think, you know, you call yourself a humanist and skeptic. I think that's in your little description. And I think that's a very interesting kind of position. Can I just ask you, before we get into the question of region, why do you identify yourself as a humanist and a skeptic?
Well, I think in simple terms, what being a humanist is that you value your relationship between humans rather than with a supernatural being, I guess. And that's how I see my worldview is.
Okay. Yeah. Because it does inform the way you analyze politics in Malaysia, I think, because you don't necessarily take a kind of, community or ethno-linguistic kind of position on issues.
Perhaps. I think how it would help me look at things that I don't... Perhaps you take a look at the issue from another way, I guess. I mean, relationships between people rather than how you want to satisfy certain... You know, higher powers and all that.
Okay, the higher powers are one thing, but there's also really important group identities. And what we see emerging in Malaysia are group identities based on sort of regional identities or state identities. So we, of course, have not just Sarawak and Sabah pulling away and asserting themselves, but we also have Johor in the south. Mm-hmm. But let's just take one particular instance I thought was really fascinating was the controversy over staffing by Petronas in Sarawak. Right, and we saw very strong statements made about the lack of representation of Sarawakians in especially the upper echelons of Petronas' operations. And we, in fact, had an action taken by the Sarawak state government, right? They kind of said they were going to refuse work visas.
Yeah, put a moratorium on work visas.
Sorry, peninsula-based or peninsular Malaysians.
Coming into work in Sarawak, right? So I think that was also after that quota put in place to have I don't know if that's quota. Or aspirational target to have this many percentage of local Sarawakians employed.
Zura, do you think, right, Adnan Satim, he came in a very strong mandate. He rode the rhetoric of state rights. Can he, in fact, deliver? And we were told at the last state assembly that this was where it was going to happen. It was going to... Can he deliver on what are, you know, of increasingly high expectations for state autonomy coming out of Sarawak?
I think he has been criticised lately, didn't he? I mean, he tried to table a bill for greater rights for Sarawak, but, I mean, he flipped it out at the last minute, if I remember that correctly. So I think that's where it comes. I mean, is it just personal politics within UMNO and BN, or is it... as you said earlier, I mean, does it have to do with state rights?
Because the basis is kind of a kind of reading of history, right? So they're saying that, in fact, in some ways, the history has sort of marginalized them. The actual practice of federalism, they want to return to the original compact.
Shira, do you think this is just limited to Sarawak, or do you think there was spillover to Sabah? Because, you know, it was largely focused on Sarawak and Adnan Satim, right?
Yeah, but there was a spillover, right? Once Shafi Abdal was removed from cabinet, and therefore UMNO, the politics of Sabah seems to be also evolving.
It's an interesting time because I was just talking with my auntie the other day about how Shafi Abdal's new party is how's the reception over there. I mean, it's surprisingly getting a lot of traction, and I think it goes into this sort of like it's not just a national thing, but I think it's an international viewpoint of getting more local and insular. So with Sabah, you. I mean, all this while, right? I mean, you have politicians based in Peninsula Malaysia, or party that has its base trying to determine what's happening in East Malaysia. And I think more people are realizing that perhaps that is not how it should be.
Yeah, well, Sarawak, of course, bucked that trend because PBB helped and is the hegemonic power in Sarawak, whereas Sabahans allowed UMNO to enter and reconfigure their politics.
It's not just
UMNO,
I mean, it's with the opposition parties as well. I mean, we see a lot of people from PKR. I mean, a lot of their leaders jumping over.
Yeah. Right, Daryl Lee King, I think, was one of the big names from PKR leaving the leadership. Mm. Now, coming back from this regional push also is happening south of us with Johor, with the added dimension of the royals.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah, I think a good... how do I say this? I think what underpins everything is that there is a leadership gap. So as in Sarawak, as it is in Sabah as well, when there is a gap, I think people are turning to other leaders. And in the case of Johor, the monarchy is trying to assert themselves more. It's not just in Johor, but we also see more royals are playing a bigger role, even in Kelantan, even in Perak. So I think that is what's happening in Johor.
Okay. So just to clarify, the leadership gap is really at a national level,
yeah,
right?
Federal level.
So yeah. the federal level, especially I think as Najib Razak's administration has been battered with the 1MDB controversy, the sense of moral leadership, especially, right? Ethical and moral leadership, that's where the deficit is most felt, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, with the new Yang di-Pertuan Agong that we had just... have recently, I mean, after the swearing in, we have a lot of, I mean, I've been hearing a lot of anecdotes about how, what kind of role that the monarchy can play in determining the well-being of the citizens. Well, there's also the issue of how that fits into the constitutional monarchy. But you can see here that people, some people are turning to the royalties for solutions. And
okay, yeah, is this something that we've seen kind of ramp up this year? And I'm trying to remember, when was the first time I heard the term Bangsa Johor? And I assume it must have been sometime this year, because previously I wasn't made aware of that such a term.
Zurairi and I are both Johorians, by the way.
Ah, I see. I'm outnumbered. Okay.
My parents are from Johor. So let's hope.
But you're a humanist, so that's more important. That trumps all these
I think Bangsa Johor, I think, it might have only reached into mainstream attention probably in the past 1 or 2 years, but I think the sentiment itself has always been around with the Johorians. I guess I'm not sure about Shara's generation, but
that's a dark ages Shara.
But ever since I was small, I've been there is this feeling that Johor is special, so it goes into that sentiment.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. But there's another dimension to the royals in Johor, which is the question of business, right? So you have this, because I remember, because the Sultan of Johor making very strong statements, especially when the red shirts were massing in KL, saying, no, I'm not going to allow these kind of chauvinists into the state. And he was making all the right statements about Johor for everybody, for, you know, inclusive and such. So all the right sounds. But behind it also is, I think his attempt to get some executive powers to a particular bill, not this year, but I think it was last year, and then his business dealings, especially with the Forest City development, that's huge.
That's mind blowing. I mean, I was just a couple of months ago. I mean, I went to the. I mean, my friend said that. I mean, when the Chinese make a development, they don't do show houses. They do show buildings. Wow. And in this case,
show
of Forest City,
it's
show city. is literally a township built out of nowhere. I mean, rising from the seas.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing about it is that it's already kind of been politicized, because Dr. Mate came out warning, about, Johor being inundated, not by Malaysian Chinese, but by People's Republic of China Chinese. I think Air Asia has now
direct
flight. And also the Menteri Besar of Johor came out having to respond to Mahathir's allegations. A lot of very interesting stories on the business front. We're talking mostly about politics today, but there's also that dimension of it, right? I mean, the question also is, can the royals be disinterested parties in trying to provide moral leadership, when in fact they are also invested in business?
Business. I mean, they also have a certain immunity. So how do you? I mean, no, it comes into freedom of expression as well. I mean, how? I mean, you can. There's of course protection against defamation and all that. But how do you deal with criticism when it comes to that?
Right. So how can they enter into political discourse and then not be somehow be above the kind of criticism that comes from being a voice in that?
Well, I guess as we wrap up the show, Zurairi, we want to kind of pick your brain and find out what you think could be some game changers going into next year. So we've done a review of the year past. Now, going into the year forward, what would be some of the big things that we'll be watching out for next year?
Well, the general elections, of course.
Okay, so you look. I know you brought your crystal ball with you in your bag. So tell us, when will the general election be held?
I think... I think Straits Times just did an infographic yesterday. It cited, I mean, according to them, I mean, looking at all the festivities and all that, it's either April or October, which sucks because I'm going on a holiday in April.
So, journalists, won't you recall, then they suspend
all holidays?
We might, which would suck.
Okay, all right. So, the 14th general election's something to watch out in the coming year, of course. The question is when it will be held is one that only a crystal ball can answer. Or maybe crystal ball and Putrajaya might be able to answer that a bit better than
us. I think Jamil Khair came out and said only God knows when the next election is.
Okay, I don't think
he meant that in that English expression, God knows. I think he literally meant that.
Okay. 9:58 right now. We want to be give a big thanks to Zurairi for being on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Zurairi AR, Assistant News Editor and Columnist with the Malay Mail Online. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan, and you've been listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.